is the Cloud Enough Podcast, your launchpad for Amazon Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloud Enough Podcast. My name is Michael.
And my name is Andreas.
We are brothers and freelancers focusing on Amazon Web Services. We do technical coaching, for example, for teams that start their journey with AWS, and infrastructure bootstrapping, typically based on our infrastructure as code templates for our clients worldwide. Every other week, we discuss a topic related to AWS here in the podcast. One of us prepares the topic, and the topic is not known to the other one. So, Andreas, what's the subject today?
Michael, today we will talk about different storage options on AWS. So we will compare them to give you an idea of what options are available and when you need to come up with an architecture to decide for the best option that you have.
So this is episode number 24, and we are recording this on July 28 in 2020. So before we start, I have one question for Andreas, and then we dive into the topic. So Andreas, what's going on? What are you working on at the moment?
Yeah, Michael, at the moment, we are working on releasing the third chapter for the video course Rapid Docker on AWS. So a short reminder, Rapid Docker on AWS is already available as an ebook, and we are currently working on delivering a video course as well. The first two chapters, so around 50%, are already available, and now it's up to deliver chapter 3 and 4, and chapter 3 is currently in recording, so we are preparing slides, examples, recording the video, and so on. But if you already want to start with reading the book and going to the first two chapters, you can already get Rapid Docker on AWS, the video course as well. You will find links and all relevant information in the show notes.
Great. So that sounds very interesting, and I'm looking forward to work on exactly this topic. So Andreas, let's dive into the storage options on AWS. So what different options do you have for us?
Yeah, so I think the thing is, when you design an architecture for AWS, the storage part is most often a very critical part, especially when you have workloads where you have specific needs for the I/O system on AWS. So we will cover today instance store. We will talk about the Elastic Block Storage, EBS. We'll talk about Elastic File System, EFS. We will also have a look at FSx, the file system for Windows File Server service. And last but not least, the simple storage service, S3. We will compare them, give you an introduction when it's worth to look into those services when designing an architecture, because there's one spoiler I can make now. There are pros and cons for most of those services, and in many use cases you have the option to choose between multiple options, so then it comes to what pays off for your workload.
Yeah, I see. So as often, so there is not like the best solution. There are probably like a few solutions, and then you have to pick the best one for your scenario. So I understand that we are not going to talk about databases. Is this correct?
Yes. So databases is something we have summarized in a blog post as well. So you can check that out. But now it's bare metal storage systems. So no databases involved here. And another thing that I want to state at the beginning is that this podcast episode also comes with a blog post. And the blog post appeared on the CloudCraft blog first. So CloudCraft is a tool that you can use to draw diagrams for AWS architectures. And I think it's fair to say that those are the best looking diagrams that you can come up with when creating architectures for AWS. Yeah, you'll find a link to the original blog post in the show notes as well, because it might be interesting to read to some of the details later. So check that out. And also bookmark the CloudCraft blog. It is definitely worth it.
Okay, Andrea. So you mentioned that we have like multiple options. So what's your, like, or how do you start looking and analyzing your requirements? So what are the like the important factors that I have to consider when I choose a storage solution?
Good question, Michael. So I think there are a few questions that I would start with when deciding for a storage option. So first question is, what are the durability and availability requirements for your workload? This is an important question. Next one is, how much data do you need to store? So are we talking gigabyte, terabyte, or even more than that? And what's the baseline and burst I/O throughput required by your workload? So this is a very interesting question, helping you to decide which storage option fits your needs. What's the interface your workload expects to read and write data? A file system? Does your workload offer an S3 integration, or can you build your own? And does the workload rely on low latency when accessing data from storage? And what level of latency is tolerable here? So those are very important questions that you should have answers to before you really start looking into your options, because otherwise it's really hard to decide for one option here. Okay, cool. So let's start with Instance Store. So Instance Store is an interesting option. It is basically storage that is that lives on the same hardware that your virtual machine does. Basically, that means you have the machine in the data center, and on that machine you have the CPU, the memory, and the storage. And this is Instance Store. So Instance Store has two important upsides. It is, you have very low latency to access that block storage, and high throughput. So that is what is interesting here. What's a little bit, or what can be a little bit irritating at the beginning is, how do you get Instance Store? So where do you get that option from? So basically, Instance Store is attached to your virtual machine depending on the instance type that you choose when launching an EC2 instance. So the instance type also comes, or some instance type comes with Instance Store as well. I want to give you a few examples here, Mike. So an M5 large instance, for example, comes with 2 CPU cores, 8 GB of memory. But it does not provide any instance store. But there is another instance family, and the instance type M5D large comes with the same CPU and memory specification, but also provides 75 GB of an SSD. So you can often find instance types from other instance families that have the same CPU and memory configuration, but then come with additional instance store. And on the older instance types, we had specific instance families that only that provided those instance store options as well. Okay, so that is the upsides of using instance store. It is, how do you get it? But what are the problems when using instance store? So the problem with instance store is AWS calls it ephemeral storage. Which means you should not rely on Instance Store as a persistent data store, because the Instance Store volumes have the same life cycle than your EC2 instance, which means if you stop and then later start your EC2 instance, for example, the storage will be gone. So all the data will be lost. So whenever your EC2 instance disappears for some reason, your data will disappear as well. So that is important to know. So what does that mean? So if you want to use Instance Store because of the high throughput and low latency, you need to make sure that your system replicates the data, for example, to other EC2 instances, or you do snapshots or something of your data. And typical use cases for that are, for example, distributed data stores like Elasticsearch, Kafka, where the system itself is taking care of replicating the data among multiple nodes in the cluster, Or, of course, you can use Instance Store just for temporary data, for caches, batch processing, basically whenever you can refetch the data from some other system when needed. So that is, of course, another interesting option here.
Yeah, so I can agree. And also I want to like add here that it is like if you are like running like typical web applications on AWS or enterprise applications, then chances that you need Instance Store are very low. So I usually don't use Instance Store very often. So it's really in the special cases. And for example, you mentioned Elasticsearch and Kafka, all those services are available as managed services. So in those cases, you can also just get the whole service from AWS. So yeah, basically what I wanted to say is that Instance Store is nice, but it is not a big deal if you never used it, because it's really, I think it's kind of niche. I mean, there are definitely workloads that use it and that require it, but like typical applications, they don't need Instance Store, and it's not used so often, I think.
Yeah, it's definitely not for beginners, and it's also not the default storage system that is attached to an EC2 instance. That's correct. Which brings me to the default block storage for AWS, which is the Elastic Block Storage Service, EBS. So I'm thinking of EBS as a storage area network. So your EC2 instance, the virtual machine, is connected to a storage system over wire, over network. And typically, there is a one-to-one relationship between an EC2 instance and an EBS volume. And what you have to keep in mind when thinking about EBS and adding that to your architecture is there is network in between. What's the thing here? So the network in between adds a little bit of latency. So even if most EC2 instances are optimized for EBS usage, which means they have a dedicated network connectivity to the storage system, still you have a little bit of latency in between compared to Instance Store. And the other thing that you have to keep in mind is that the network capacity of your EC2 instance and the EBS volume are both a possible bottleneck for transferring data between your EC2 instance and the volume, the EBS volume. So that is what is important to keep in mind, the network in between. On the other hand, EBS comes with a lot of advantages. So I think the most important advantage is the life cycle of the EBS volume is independent of the EC2 instance. So you can stop or even terminate, delete your virtual machine, and this does not affect the data stored on the volume. So you can therefore consider the EBS volume as persistent storage. So this is a key differentiator to the instance store. Also, EBS replicates data among multiple disks automatically. AWS says they aim for a durability of 99.8% over a year. So which means your data is not only stored on one disk, it is replicated on multiple disks out of the box. And another interesting feature that EBS comes with is you can create snapshots of volumes, incremental snapshots. And those snapshots are then stored among multiple availability zones. So that is another very cool feature. What is important to know about the limitations is we talked about the maximum throughput that depends on the EC2 instance type and the EBS configuration. But what is also important is you provision the storage capacity of the volume up front. You can change it later, but that requires you to have a short downtime. You cannot do that on the fly. So provisioning that from the beginning typically means you over-provision your storage capacity to avoid planned downtimes later. And the other important thing is EBS replicates data among multiple disks, but it does not replicate your data among multiple availability zones. So that is often something you have to think about when you persist data and when you basically also need to access that data for your application to be fully functioning. So this is the instance. The instance that is connected to the EBS volume, both are running in a single availability zone. And the SLA that AWS provides for that is an uptime of 90%. So that is what AWS promises to deliver. And oftentimes that might not be sufficient. So if your application really relies on EBS and being able to access the data on the volume, you need to find a way to replicate your data to another availability zone. And unfortunately, that is not always so easy to do. So you could use EBS snapshots. Problem here is we don't have any guarantees on the recovery time objective. So we don't have any guarantees on how long it takes for AWS to create a new volume based on a snapshot. So yeah, you could, for example, replicate your data on your own onto a second machine. Yeah, but that's something we have to think about when using EBS volumes.
Okay, Andrea. So I have, I think I have three comments. So the first comment is that you mentioned that you can attach an EBS volume to a single EC2 instance. And there's some like innovation going on in this field because AWS now allows for like very specific instance types to that you can attach the same volume to multiple instances, which is pretty nice. The problem with that is that you have to manage on the software, like basically if you have one machine that only writes and all the others only read, then there's no big problems. But if you like think about that multiple machines are going to write on the same volume, then you will end up with kind of chaos. And you have to orchestrate and ensure that they don't override each other. So that it's not, I think it's not easy to use, and there will be some applications that can benefit from it. But yeah, so that's just like a note that there's something going on that, that might improve that situation.
Yeah, correct, Michael. But one thing I want to ask you, I've read about that as well, that you can attach multiple machines to the same volume now. But I think, am I right? This is only possible within one availability zone, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So it does not solve the availability zone problem, but still sometimes it helps, but it doesn't replicate across availability zones. That's right. Yeah, and the other problem that you mentioned with restoring EBS snapshots, so maybe I can like add some details here. If you create a volume and based on a snapshot, AWS does copy the data onto the volume asynchronously. So whenever you kind of access a block on the device that is not yet restored, then AWS will fetch the data. So this basically means that you have very poor performance at the first, like. And then, as you mentioned, the undefined number of minutes or hours, because this replication process can take some time. But there's also some innovation going on in this space. So there is a way to kind of speed up the restore process if you pay an additional fee. So that can also help to reduce the gap a little bit. But yeah, still it's a challenge to kind of back up and restore your EBS volumes. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I think that the thing that I worry here about the most is when really your recovery strategy from an AWS outage relies on restoring big amounts of data from EBS snapshots. I doubt that when all AWS customers in that region start to do so, you will probably have to wait very long for that to completely finish and restore all your data. That is what I'm thinking of here. So I think that is something to keep in mind when building architectures where you have to fulfill very hard availability requirements. Yeah,
I see. Yeah.
Okay. You had a third comment, Michael.
My third comment was about Like you mentioned that if you like resize a volume, and resize basically means you increase the size, so there's no way to decrease the size of a volume. You mentioned that there will be a short downtime, and I'm not 100% sure if that is correct or if this is also possible to resize without a downtime. I think it depends a little bit on the file system.
Yes, you are correct. So it depends definitely on the file system, and it also depends on the instance types, whether this supports elastic volumes. Okay, yeah, so this is instance store and EBS elastic block storage. So both options are block storage options, which means you have to define your own file system on top. So basically your operating system is doing that for you. So you choose the file system of your choice, and then you're writing blocks of data to those storage systems. The next system that we want to talk about is a little bit different. It is the Elastic File System, EFS. EFS is based on a protocol that is now older than 35 years, Michael. I looked that up. That is really, I would say this is computer and internet history. So NFS, the Network File System. And NFS allows you to connect multiple machines to the same file system via the network.
Yeah, and so like maybe like a fun fact is that it was invented before I was born. So
okay, I'm not sure if that is a if that's a good sign to for technology, but yeah, of course, on the other side, it should be. It should be stable, yeah. Okay, but I think it's not obsolete. It's still an interesting system. So what about EFS? So EFS is it's really a cloud native service. If you want to have the password here, so because the storage capacity grows on demand, you only pay for the storage that you use. So this is different to EBS. And also different to instance store, where you basically pay for the storage that you provision up front. So that is great. And we can adjust the maximum I/O throughputs to our needs. There is provision capacity, which means you can get a stable capacity for reading and writing from your Elastic File System. And there's also the other option, the cheaper option, which is burstable performance, depending on the storage size. Also, and that is a first here, is that data is replicated among multiple availability zones by default. So you don't have to care about what happens if one availability zone is no longer reachable because of an outage in the data center, because the service itself replicates the data, and you can still access that data even if one availability zone fails. And this is working out of the box. The NFS file system protocol in between. So that is really easy to use. So I would say EFS is a perfect thing to choose when you have multiple machines that have to access the same file system, the same data stored on a file system. So a few typical examples when I'm using EFS. So a lot of content management systems out there, so WordPress, what have you, require a file system. And as I want to spread my workloads on multiple machines, I'm using EFS to have a shared file system here. But it's also interesting for CI/CD applications like Jenkins, GitLab, where you have to store data in file systems as well. Many legacy web applications require a file system. Also, a lot of enterprise applications that I've seen require a shared file system. So this is a good choice whenever you need to store files on disk, but you want to share that file system with many machines. There's only one thing that you have to keep in mind. EFS is not really designed for latency critical workloads. So the protocol NFS is really causing additional latency. So I think it's not a good idea to use it for anything like a database like system, or whenever you have a system where really latency to the data to the files is critical, then EFS is not a good choice.
Yeah, so I was surprised recently, because this is also kind of the rule of thumb that I use when thinking about EFS, that, okay, for small files, like many small files, or at least like if there's a high frequency of operations, then you might be running into issues. But then I learned that, like when we talked about messaging on AWS in the episode before, that Amazon MQ, which is the hosted ActiveMQ service, uses by default, if you run the system in high availability mode, uses EFS for persistence. And they also clearly document that this will, like, the limitations, like the system can only process 80 messages, I think, per second or something like this. But still, they use this as a persistence layer for a, I mean, it's not a database system, but it's a messaging system. So if your requirements are low enough in terms of writes per second, then it might still be an option. And it looks like that 80 messages per second, which, I mean, very like simply calculated 80 write operations per second, maybe 160 or something like this, is enough and can be satisfied with EFS. So that was interesting for me, because I have never like expected something like this to be created by AWS using EFS as a storage layer.
Yeah, on the other side, we have seen many scenarios where we really had problems with the latency caused by EFS. So we had big GitLab installations or other systems where they store a lot of files and needed to access them. We heard and have seen problems with that. But yeah, I think it really depends on the workloads, and I think it's necessary to do some performance tests when you go with EFS. Yeah,
and I'm not sure if I just missed this or if you haven't mentioned it, but EFS only works with Linux. So you cannot mount it from Windows. I'm not sure if that was like highlighted.
Yeah, I missed that. Yeah, that's an important restriction. Yeah, but that's because of the file system protocol, the NFS version 4 is only available on Linux machines. So you can only mount it from there. Yeah, good point, Michael. On the other hand, it is available. You can mount it over a private network, for example, a VPN or Direct Connect connection. So you can, in theory, access NFS from on-premises if you really want to. Which definitely will increase latency and more, but that's possible.
Yeah, so what's next? I think EFSX is next.
Yeah, so file system. So there are two. So EFSX basically means that AWS does provide or wants to provide multiple managed file system services under the same umbrella. So at the moment, there is file system for Windows File Server, and there is the other option, let me try to remember, FSX for Lustre. So those are the two options at the moment, and probably or maybe AWS will announce other managed shared file systems in the future. So I had a look at the file system for Windows File Server a little bit deeper. So I went to the documentation and asked a few support questions, played around with it a little bit to basically find out about the limitations and the special things about that service. Some disclaimer here, I'm not a Windows and Microsoft guy. I have almost zero experience with operating Windows servers. So keep that in mind when I'm talking about it here. So, but what's important from a storage option point of view here is EFS is a little bit similar to FSX because both are shared file systems that you can use over network. However, a file system for Windows file servers can be used from Windows, Linux, macOS, and so on, because the protocols they use are available on all those systems. So that is maybe interesting here. So it might not only be for Windows servers, you can even use it from Linux servers as well. And a few differences between FSX and EFS. So basically, FSx for Windows File Server is AWS manages Windows file servers for you. So they configure them, they monitor them, they maintain them, and you get access to a Windows file server system. There are two options. There is a multi-availability zone option that you can use, but it's not enabled by default. So you can deploy a second server, a standby server, and then you get multi-AZ deployments in at least in two availability zones. So the SLA that you get out of that is 99.9% availability. And then this FSx replicates the data to the standby server automatically. If you compare that with EFS, the data is replicated to at least three different availability zones, and it comes with an availability objective of 99.99%. So there's a fourth nine here. That might be a difference. So if you have an availability requirement, that's something you should keep in mind.
Yeah, so if I think about the file system for Windows, it's kind of an RDS. I mean, it's it can be like a single instance or it can be two, but it's basically one machine, if I understand it correctly. And like EFS is really a distributed system that can, and I think I'm not sure if you mentioned this, but for Windows file system, you have a storage maximum, like there's a limit. And EFS is something that grows with your, you can add files along the way and without worrying about the maximum amount of storage that you can put into EFS. So that's kind of I usually think about EFX as an RDS instance, but it does not offer MySQL or something. It offers a Samba kind of functionality. Not sure if that really is how it works, but this is how it feels from looking at the system from the outside.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah. So another interesting difference between FSx and EFS, if we want to compare those two, is that FSx comes with an interesting feature of the Windows file server, which is data deduplication. So when you have, for example, when you store user directories with FSx, the thing here is if many people store the exact same file within their directory, within their personal directory, FSx will only store that once on disk. So that is something, a great feature that you can use to reduce the needed storage. So that is maybe, that's something that I was stumbling upon when going through the details here. So I think the same that is true for EFS is true for FSx as well. If you really have a latency critical workload, the overhead of the protocol to synchronize the different nodes that write to the file system is adding additional latency that you probably cannot tolerate here if it's really latency critical. Okay, last but not least, Michael, let's talk about Simple Storage Service. So this is a service that is different, different to the four options that we talked about so far. The difference here is AWS offers a REST API that is accessible from the internet. And this REST API allows us to read and write data from S3. So it is a service that you can use over internet. You can use it for public data, but you can also use it only from your internal network. For example, when you use VPC and then VPC endpoint, it works for both options for many, many different scenarios. The cool thing about a simple storage service is it distributes your data among multiple availability zones. And the storage capacity and also the read-write capacity scales on demand. So this is really the most cloud-native service to store your data that you can get on AWS, I would say. Because if you compare it with EFS, you cannot even provision any throughput here. That works out of the box. AWS is responsible for for doing that. And that is an interesting thing here, the simple with the simple storage service. What is important to think about is it comes with a REST API. That means this is not something that you can use as a file system on your machine. It's also not intended to be used as a file system because it's an object store. And maybe we can quickly discuss what's the difference between a block storage and an object storage, Michael. Michael, can you do that?
Yeah, sure. So, if you work with an object store, the finest granular way of accessing your data is the object, so you can get the whole file, basically, no matter how big that is. And with a block storage, you can get a specific block. So you can get, if you change a file, for example, and with an object store, you have to upload the whole file again. With a block storage, you only have to modify the block where the data is changed, and you can leave all the other blocks untouched. And this is obviously way more efficient if you change files rapidly. So for example, if you append data to a log file, like a text, like access log of your Apache log files, and you synchronize this file with an S3 bucket, you will upload the file every time you synchronize and like the whole file. And with a block storage appending lines, it would be much easier to implement and much more efficient, so you don't have to write the whole file every time, you only write like the new blocks. So that's kind of the major difference here. The good news is that you don't really, if you use the block storage, you don't really notice that. It's all handled for you usually. So it's easy to use, but still there's a lot of efficiency under the hood.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that is the thing to think about here. So a few use cases for S3. So I already said it's really a service that you can use for many, many different scenarios. So a few ones. So I'm using S3 to back up my MacBook Air. So I have a backup software that writes my backup encrypted to an S3 bucket. Second example, hosting a static website. So cloudonaut.io is our website and our blog, and it runs on S3 and CloudFront in front of that. So you can do web hosting with S3. You can exchange data for analytics, machine learning between different organizations. So that is something that we see quite often, that different organizations use S3 to share data, to have a process in place, an ETL process maybe, where one delivers data and the other one picks up the data to analyze the data, to do machine learning on the data, and then deliver back the results, for example. We use S3 to store snapshots from Elasticsearch, from business applications, and so on. You can use S3 to store user-generated content. So, very simple example, the profile picture that your users upload from their mobile devices, for example. So, many, many different scenarios here for using S3. They all have in common that it is very easy to access S3 because you have that public available REST interface that you can use to upload and download your data. And that is, I think, why S3 is very popular. Yeah, so maybe one thing here, so we talked about that. So it is possible to use S3 as a storage system in more and more software, also from third parties or open source projects. But if you really have a legacy application that relies on a file system, that does probably not qualify for storing data on S3 here. So that is when you do lift and shift migrations to AWS, probably using S3 is not an option. But that might change in the future.
Okay, great. So I think we are through the list of different options, and you have created a great comparison table that our listeners can find when they click on the link in the show notes to the blog post, because I think it's very hard to summarize a table in the podcast here, so you're not going to do that, I guess. So is there anything else to add, Andreas, or are we through the storage options?
So Michael, maybe a few things that I want to mention from the comparison table is The storage costs is an important criteria that we can compare. So the cheapest service to store data on AWS, when you just look at what does it cost to store the data, not to access the data, is S3. And the most expensive one is EFS. And so the difference is here more than 10x. Yeah. So this is really interesting. The different cost options for storing data that might also this is also an important thing to consider when choosing a service, of course. We discussed that instance store and EBS are only available in single AZ modus, which means you can only get that in a single availability zone. This is also something that is important. And also, it's interesting to have a look. It's always interesting to have a look at the limitations. So what is the maximum throughput that you can get for the different options? Because here, there are also important differences. Yeah, so I would say have a look at the comparison table. And one more thing at the end, Michael, after we have gone through the different storage options, I came up with a decision tree. And the decision tree asks different questions. So the questions are, who needs to access the storage service? How does a typical file access pattern look like? What's your durability requirement? Does your application offer an S3 integration? And which operating system is used? And by answering those questions, you go through the decision tree and find at least a direction for which storage service fits your needs best. Any other questions about storage on AWS, Michael, or is that everything you wanted to know?
Yeah, I think that's all I need to know, and that's probably all that is needed to make the decision and choose the right option. So thanks very much for providing all this information to me and to the listeners. So yeah, I think we can close this, Andreas, or is there something that needs to be added?
Yeah, the only thing I want to say at the end of the podcast episode is please, when you listen to this podcast episode, make sure that you have subscribed to the whole show wherever you listen to podcasts to make sure that you do not miss our future episodes. Also, please recommend this podcast to a friend to spread the word about it. And let us know if you like this episode. Send us a message on Twitter, LinkedIn, or via email.
Yeah, great. That sounds like a good idea. And also, if you have like the ability to write a review or to add stars to our show, that is highly appreciated as well, and kind of a big motivation for us to continue here as well as your feedback. So thank you, Andreas. Thanks for preparing the episode and providing all those insights. I guess we can close this here and say goodbye, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah, thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.